Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Buckhead Business Radio Show.
Yes, it's that time again of the week, Tuesday mornings at 10 o'clock. Rich Casanova here, your host for Buckhead Business Radio. We've got a great lineup of guests in the studio this morning, some interesting conversation, a range of topics, and if time permitting, we may even make it a round table and just every man for himself, whatever, a little open forum discussion. Yeah, could get a little dicey here this morning, but that's what we like here at Business Radio. But if you're just tuning in for the first time, we are pro-business, unabashedly pro-business radio, so we want to make a note of our guest here first. Terrence, welcome to the show. We'll be speaking with you a little bit later. And what are we going to be talking about this morning?
Our new software that's coming out is called Rita 2.0.
Yeah. So forget the 1.0, right? You blew way past that. Yeah,
exactly.
So yeah, I kind of been checking that out a little bit. And we have a mutual friend, Jerome Washington. So you guys are teaming up on this project, or he's just... how is he involved or not?
He's one of the consultants on the project.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Well, welcome to the show. We'll be hearing your story in just a moment. And also joining us in the studio is Emil Parody. Emil, welcome back to the show. How are you this morning?
It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
Yeah, did we all get the votes? Are you running for office this week, or was that last week, or yeah, or next week? You should run next week.
I'm always running.
Exactly, for something, yeah. You're a write-in candidate for if there's a, another election. I guarantee there's an election in your future, yeah. And you recently moved over to a different part of Atlanta?
Yeah, I moved from east to west, Marietta.
And eventually north to south, you'll have it all covered, right?
Yeah, that's it. Got new friends.
Yeah. So you're going to be telling us about networking and some international events and some workshops and...
Yeah, we'll be talking a little bit about some international stuff, I hope, today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're looking forward to that. And first up, joining us in the studio, first time on the show, is Jeff Smith. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Rich, for having me here. No Rich from networking around Atlanta. It's great to see you in your element and doing what you do, and I'm real happy to be here. And usually, when I talk about more, I'm a mortgage banker,
right.
And so usually when I talk about that at parties, my wife kicks me under the table, right. And nobody wants to listen. So,
well, everybody's listening. We're all ears now. Whatever, yeah.
So, you have a great audience then.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we probably got kicked out of one of Emil's networking events where he crashed one of his events or something. But yeah,
that's possible.
So networking is that's the place to make business happen here in Atlanta, undoubtedly. So Jeff, for listeners that may not know about you, before we get into your business and talking mortgages and what's going on, because everybody needs one, and looking for always some good ideas and the latest update and news. But you actually started out as a business news reporter, right?
I did. True? Yes, that's correct. My dream when I first started out was to be a Wall Street Journal newspaper reporter, and I started out with the Appen News Group up in Alpharetta, writing business news for their Business Post up there, which I think they're starting to bring back again. Fun job, one of the funnest jobs you could have as a young guy. You know, it lets you in the room of all the big people where normally you wouldn't. So,
with the big dogs or whatever.
That's exactly right. Yeah. It was a great experience.
But you're also nationally certified firefighter?
Yeah.
I don't know, a mortgage guy could also fight fires, whatever.
Well, that was before kids. Me and my wife, we live in the little town of Mountain Park, which I'm not sure, usually real estate agents and eccentrics know Mountain Park. It's a very small town. It's mostly covered by Roswell. It's got a great history. It was actually started back in the 20s during Prohibition because the main resident there was known to make really good moonshine.
All right. So nice. We're heading up there after the show, folks. Yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
So it was a very unique town in the late 60s. I think it became a hippie commune type place. And there's a mix of hippie communes and good old boys. And it's a very interesting town.
I say we do a live broadcast. And we're going to take the show on the road up here next week. Yeah.
There are stories up there. Al Capone actually was known to have a brothel in Mountain Park.
Well, we never had this conversation, though. But
once
you bring his name in. Yeah. But interesting on, there's no segue here, just an interesting spin. But also I've noticed, so you worked 8 years North Fulton Boulevard for the March of Dimes and Walk America Committee?
That's correct. Got on board with that when I was a reporter. I was asked to be a part of the committee and raise a lot of money. I think we raised $500,000 a couple years up there, just reaching out to businesses. It was a really, really great organization. And we did that for 8 years. We reach out to business and we ask them to raise money however they want. And the businesses in North Fulton did very well.
Well, I'm just glad you're not a radio news reporter. Put me out of a job, whatever. Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. So back to Atlanta. You're in native Atlanta, right?
Correct.
And so what have you seen? Because we have a lot of people that new to Atlanta and may not know some of the recent history. What are some things that you've noticed in communities the process or the evolution last, say, 30 years?
Well, when I was young, if you were an adult in Atlanta and you wanted to go out, most of the time you were driving, and out in Roswell, especially where I grew up, you're driving from strip mall to strip mall, And now, to me, it's really great the way Atlanta's grown up. I like to say that I'd like to be from a place that everybody's moving to instead of where they're moving from. And people complain about the traffic here all the time, but to me, that's a symptom of success. And someone told me one time, you never hear people in Detroit complaining about traffic, So... the way it's grown up, I think right now, it seems that our whole area is really maturing in a lot of ways. A lot of these suburbs and everybody are creating these city centers, and it's really become a very fun town to be in. Downtown Roswell is really happening. There's a lot of stuff going on in Sandy Springs up the road. Buckhead won this new development.
Yeah, Buckhead Atlanta.
Buckhead Atlanta, yeah.
Yeah, they took over the old streets of Buckhead. That's a major endeavor. And then Alpharetta, Avalon, a $600 million.
Avalon is insane. That development, they haven't... my understanding, it's so high-end that when you're walking around, they have concierge service for anybody on... just walking around. You can call up and order a burger while you're shopping.
See, I like that because I feel like I got my posse follow me around, my entourage or whatever. Right? I don't have to pay them or anything. Yeah,
that's right.
What's new?
Okay, so meanwhile, back to business. Yeah. So we talked about networking. Emil and myself and other folks throughout Atlanta are involved in networking events. So talk about this, the balance of networking and community involvement. You're involved in the chamber. Which chamber is that?
North Fulton. Okay, right. Greater North Fulton Chamber.
And youth sports. So talk to us about that.
The sports?
Well,
all of it. Yeah. Just being involved in the community, especially for somebody in business like me, where I reach out to people in the community. It's really great because I get to do kind of what I like, which is being out and meeting people, and then it's also good for business, so it eases my conscience as well. Right. So I can coach my son's 5- and 6-year-old flag football team, which we just won the championship up there.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. You guys are the only ones in town that know that, that didn't know that by now. So, but it allows me to do stuff like that, which I can also tell myself is good for business as well.
Well, making those connections, because I think, in your business, it's somewhat of a commodity, and there's a lot of folks doing what you're doing. So not only set yourself apart, but kind of be, there's this mantra I credit BNI. What's their message? CVP, right?
Mm-hmm.
First you have to, VCP, right? Yeah, sorry. VCP, yeah. Everybody's shaking their heads like, duh. Good. I caught myself right in time there. But visibility, which you're talking about being involved in the chamber with a youth sports program and just out and about in your local community. Then that leads to credibility because people are like, he's familiar. Jeff seems like a good guy or whatever, right? And then obviously profitability. So I don't know if you can you just fast track right to the P? Probably not. Some people try to do that. It doesn't work out so well, yeah.
So you said their whole theory, a lot of people have different ways of describing it where you just help people, just do good in your community and don't worry about the immediate return. It's going to come back to you eventually. I'm not the first one to say that. Michael Mayer is somebody that I follow. Another mortgage lender I know, he has another way of putting it. I think he calls it back-assward business or something like that, where you just help people and it's the opposite of what you think. Instead of you trying to get people to help you, you go out and help them. I think that's what networking to me.
Oh, yeah. Law of reciprocity comes into play, and then you have building equity, relationship equity. So, it's good stuff. And some people get it, but sometimes it takes a while for, because you see a lot of people at networking events, and they've got a whole stack of business cards, and that's their mission. Everybody in the room is going to get my card before I leave.
That's right.
Yeah.
When I started in 2013, my goal was to go to every single networking group I could find and just plant my pretty face and start talking. And it was a good experience for me because it really helped me, talk about my craft and get in front of people and talk and meet a lot of people. But it was really hard also if you do too many networking groups. I learned you can't really do well in any one because you're spreading yourself out so thin. So this year I've certainly picked a couple that I'm really targeting and really great people and has worked out really well.
It's the rubber band CRM, right? All your business cards are wrapped in rubber bands and that's your system. Yeah. So talk to us about partners in education. Pi?
Yeah, PI, Partners in Education. So the Chamber, we're very in education and recruiting. Chamber's all about recruiting businesses and bringing in a good, making a good business environment for their area. And education and the Chamber go hand in hand. You know, when businesses want to come to an area, the first thing they ask about is education. How are the schools? They're going to have to move here and recruit employees and so on and so forth. And so they want to make sure there's good schools here. And so partnership in education, all we're doing is, this is our one little piece to try and help the schools, is to partner businesses together with schools for a mutually beneficial relationship. And so we promote every school. We work in Fulton County, North Fulton. Every school has its own way of partnering with businesses. Some of them want businesses to just come in and stroke checks. Some of them want businesses to come in and tutor, offer their expertise. And conversely, if you're a business, it's a great way for you to, like I say, do good in front of the community. Mm-hmm. And a school is a great way for you to access thousands of parents and hundreds of teachers. Now, you know, we ask you to do good for the school. It's not such a business transaction.
Right, right.
But we're not asking fifth graders to make wallets or something like the sweatshop or anything. Right. You know, but we are trying to create mutually beneficial relationships. We're also helping the schools realize if they promote those businesses well and those businesses see a return, they're going to have more incentive to come back and help those schools the next year.
And the businesses are going to be profitable, successful, so more employees, you know, more employed
Absolutely.
Parents. But especially if you're in the B2C, that would probably be behoove more the B2C than the B2B, yes or no?
I say it can go both ways because there's, especially up in North Fulton, there's a lot of business, a lot of people in positions to go B2B. You know, that have their kids at schools. And so I think it can go both ways. And also it's just good to promote your company, get your company brand out there so that people see it. And I think a lot of schools see that too.
Well, I think that's kind of the old adage too, is that people like to do business with people they you know, like and trust and familiar with. And so if they feel like, well, they're supporting, you know, what's going on in our neighborhood and in our classroom, then you know, rather than go shop on the internet or find somebody in Omaha, let's you know, shop local.
That's exactly right. Right. And that's our, it's a good point. Our motto, which somebody on our committee came up with, is strong business plus strong schools equals strong community.
Yeah,
so
there you go.
That kind of sums it up.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's talk about your wife's favorite subject now. Yeah.
Uh-oh.
mortgages.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody pretty much needs one or has had one or, yeah. So, you know, and it's almost like it's weird. We're almost a little bit distant now from this recession. The last recession, it feels like, you know, their sense
we're
of
getting there.
It's,
yep.
You know, it's kind of behind. It's not in its entirety, but so what's the current state of the market? How do things look?
Well, it's kind of interesting.
Well, bring it back up for a second. How long did you say you've been in the business?
I've really been in the business since about 2003.
Okay,
I was
yeah,
on
so
more of the construction seen, yeah. side of it, and but I've been heavily just related just to the mortgages for the past 2.5 years with Assurance
okay.
Financial.
Okay,
yeah,
nice. So I'm sorry, go back to. You know, the current state, or if you can kind of take us through a little before and after, like what were things like?
Yeah.
What was the worst scenario and how do we look now?
So, the you know, mortgages were kind of really Wild West, you know, prior to 2007. And personally, I like the way it is today. There's a lot of rules and regulations and people complain about that. I kind of like that. It's all about customer service today. Back in the day, you know, somebody could come in with a 450 credit score, you know, they just foreclosed on a house and I could tell my referral source, hey, you know, there's no way this guy's getting a loan, you know? And then 2 weeks later, the referral source would call me back and say, hey, so-and-so just gave him a loan.
Yeah.
And it was like, what? That's insane. You know, right. There's no way that's going to. So today, there's rules and regulations that kind of puts everybody on a more even playing field. And the rules are really all about customer service. And that's how you separate one lender from another. So from that perspective, I think we're in pretty good shape. The other perspective that people need to keep in mind is the federal government now owns basically the mortgage business. They own Fannie Freddie, they own FHA, they make all the rules. If you're a small business owner, and since this is a networking right. show and there's a lot of small businesses business owners listening, what you put on your tax returns now is what we have to use for income. And that's a big deal. A lot of people don't know that, but you know, it may be the federal government's way of trying to get people to pay taxes, but they came in a couple years ago and said, hey, you can't tell us you make one thing and your mortgage banker, you make something else.
Right.
You know, whatever you put on that tax return is your adjusted gross. That's what we're considering as your income.
And that's tough because their mission is to you know, show as little income as possible for,
that's right,
for their business, right?
That's right. I mean, people that work at home, you know, yeah, they're writing off a lot of stuff. I did a loan. I tried to do a loan for a fellow a couple about a month ago. He wanted a house and he fell in love with the house. Had to have the house.
Right.
Said he was making about $185,000.
Right.
He gave me his tax returns, and apparently his tax accountant did a really good job because he said he was only making $93,000,
right,
and he couldn't, you know, we couldn't do the house.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a catch 22. I mean, you got to pick one or the other, right?
His tax accountant went from like golden child to dunce in the corner real quick.
Right.
You know? Yes. You didn't tell me I wasn't gonna be able to buy a house.
Yeah, right.
So
back up for a second. Talk to us about Assurance Financial. What kind of makes them, you know, what's their backstory and yeah, a little bit of their history, but what kind of makes them, you know, unique, I guess, or
well, we're a correspondent lender, and what that means is in this industry, you kind of have two types of lenders, and we're the third. So you have your broker, and you've got your bank.
I mean, you have two, and then
we're the third.
Two,
yeah,
there's two kinds, and then there's the other kind.
That's right, the hybrid.
All right.
But we're a bank. We lend our own money, so which means everything's in-house. Our underwriting's in-house. We have our own appraisers that we use on a random, a rotating basis. That enables us to just have control of that process. What we're also like a broker. Brokers are kind of like independent sales reps where they go out and they have maybe 20 to 40 other banks that they can find you the best rate and shop you around. What we do is we have relationships with those same banks, except they let us do the underwriting and fund the loan, and then they'll buy it from us maybe a couple months later. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. We're a small company. We are a bank. We are based out of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Here,
nice.
Here in Atlanta, we're kind of a boutique shop. There's three loan officers here in the Dunwoody branch.
Yeah, what's their presence in Georgia then? Just right here in Dunwoody?
Just right here in Dunwoody. Okay. That's it. There's three
so
of us.
So local, you don't have to like call Omaha or whatever? Or, yeah.
That's right. I have two underwriters that do every one of my loans. When somebody does a loan with us, they're dealing with me and my assistant, Deborah.
Nice.
Who may be listening. Hey,
yeah,
Deborah.
A little plug-in for Deborah. Yeah. Yeah, that doesn't hurt. Yeah.
Yep. we're you know, small company, about 100 employees. Love the Baton Rouge branch. It's much different place down there.
Made a few trips down there. Emil, you've been down there a couple of times to New Orleans and that part of the world. We'll talk about that. He's biting his lip there. Yeah. Okay. So meanwhile, back to the market. So things are pretty decent now, right? Compared to, like you said, with the regulations in place, it just makes it more even keel or more solid, right? So I mean, the flip side is maybe you can't get that house that you're going to stretch to get into, but now it. You know, it's more.
Yeah, I kind of think that, you know, right now you can put as little as 3.5% down and get a house, and
really?
You can make your debt to income ratio, meaning you can have 55% of your income can go towards paying debt right now. You can still get a loan. To me, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, if you put your debt to income ratio much higher than that, and you may get a house, but you ain't leaving that house because you ain't got no money.
Right.
So to me, the rules, I think they're okay. And, I think there's some credit reporting stuff that we can work on. I think credit scores, people are being hit for things that are a little unreasonable.
Yeah, do you have like folks you work with that you source that to, or do that in-house to help beef up their or clean up their credit, I guess?
Well, we do. I've gotten pretty good at it. I can look at a credit report, and I have a matrix that I use, and where I can say, okay, if you pay down this credit card, your score is going to go up this much. If you get rid of this collections thing, you know, your score is going to go up that much. I can give folks a 5-day plan. I can give them a 2-month plan, a 6-month, and a year plan if we want to get those scores up.
Any story comes at mind that like from low to high?
Oh, I just had a fellow who we had him qualified. He had a 670 credit score.
Right.
Had him perfectly well qualified, but I said, you know what? If you get rid of this collection that's on there, your score, and then pay down this credit card to about $10, your score could go up about 100 points.
Wow.
So he's like, yeah.
Duh.
So he went ahead and did that, and we had him pre-approved at 670, but ended up with a 760 score, which gave him best execution rate.
Oh,
so,
time.
Yeah, save him about, on that loan, I saved him about $80 a month.
Yeah, so over the course of the loan, I mean, that's significant. And then
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was his new best friend.
A big time, yeah. So interest rates, talk to us about, where are they sitting ballpark, and what's affecting those rates?
Interest rates are highly... very much so have always been tied to the market conditions and what's going on in the economy. So interest rates are tied directly to bonds. And so when bonds are bought in high volume, interest rates go down. And investors buy bonds when they feel comfortable in the economy. But when the economy, there's instability, they're going to run from stocks and they're going to buy bonds. Stocks are a little more risky, but higher return sometimes. So what we have now is I like to look at interest rates. They're like a helium balloon. And there's a string, and there's a lot of hands pulling that balloon down right now. And the federal government has two hands on it. One is the two stimulus programs. They've got short-term interest rates almost near zero, which gives banks lower operating costs so they can offer lower rates. And then they've got a bond-buying program, which was at its peak at about $90 billion a month. Okay, they were buying these bonds to keep interest rates down. Now they're down to about 15.
And when was that peak?
That was back in last year, most of the in the summer and into the fall. And then December, they started pulling back. And so now they're down to about $15 billion, and they just announced that pretty soon they're going to do away with the whole program. So they feel like – so what's happened, if you'd asked me in January where rates, best execution rate is going to be at the end of the year, I would have said 5%, no doubt about it.
Right.
We're a little slower getting out of the gate, economically speaking. There was a lot of issues this year, a lot of issues. We had a lot of economic issues, which we all blamed on the weather in the beginning. We had global issues that came into
play.
That's
what I was wondering. Like all of these hot topics in the news, whatever, is there a ripple effect from that?
Just
people's like concern and, you know, it creates the, like you said, the instability in the market.
Absolutely. So you had Putin.
Yeah.
He still got his piece and now he's kind of negotiating his punishment, I guess, basically.
Right.
But then you've got what happened, throw a little bit of Gaza in there.
Yeah,
remember,
yeah,
we had a little war there. And of course, we got these psychopathic, crazy guys running across Iraq, undoing everything that we just spent the last 14 years.
And that makes
years
investors and people nervous or whatever, right?
Especially so oil rich countries.
And less reluctant.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
So, what are we looking at? What do you, you know, you can't really formally project, but what's your best guess?
My best guess, and I say this every time someone asks me, is rates are either going to go up, they're going to go down, or they're going to stay the same.
Or it depends.
Never been wrong. Right. And I was taught that a long time ago, and I made a prediction because, you know, right now rates are at 4%,
right.
4 to 4, which are great. I mean,
oh, big time. I mean, it's funny how people like, I mean, you probably hear this every day in your office, but people are like, well, I'll wait until it drops a quarter, you know, or something like that, or a fraction. But I remember a story. I don't know if it was Bob Satarian or who, but somebody in networking. I remember they tell a story. They have up, they still have up on their office or in their office on the wall, an old, you know, lemon colored paper, you know, from the Xerox machine back in the day, like in the late 70s, 78, 79, 80 or whatever. And interest rates was 18%.
Right.
And they were like, and they were screaming, "That's a deal. Get it now before it goes up." Right. You know, so it is. It's all relative.
I can, you know, like I say, it's a helium balloon. They want to go up. There's a lot of hands pulling them down. You got the government holding them down. You've got Europe holding them down. Europe's economy right now is in trouble. I mean, Germany's manufacturing is down. Those type of things are holding that balloon. They keep holding it down when you think it's going to go up. So when people ask me about rates, I can imagine a lot of scenarios where they jump up. I can't imagine a whole lot where they're going to go down. That's about as best a guess as I can.
So, Jeff, you got some good news for us today. It sounds like
finish
on a high note here.
Go buy a house
so
right
what
now.
So what makes the balloon go up then? Yeah, right? Is it the opposite of everything?
All the hands. All the hands.
Free it up.
Yep.
So finally, talk to us about the three things folks might, you know, if you had to kind of, you know, narrow it down to three things that would help position themselves, get better interest rates. You talked about it. Probably one of them was their credit score and
that's right.
Fixing that, right?
Us lenders, we use three criteria, basically: down payment, credit score, credit history, and your debt-to-income ratio.
Okay.
You know, down payment, one of the things about down payment is most people know if you're doing a conventional loan, you put down 20%, you don't have to pay mortgage insurance. You also, the more you put down, the lower your interest rate's going to be. You're going to get a better rate. 25% gets you the best execution rate. You can put as little as 5% down on a conventional loan, 3.5% on FHA. As far as credit score and credit history goes, you know, just pay your stuff on time. Find out if there's a collections on there. Try and get rid of the collections. One thing people do not know about collections are if you pay a collection off, and this is something I think is wrong with the credit reporting.
Yeah.
If you pay a collection off or don't pay it off, your score is going to be the exact same. If you do anything, you need to get the company to delete that from your credit report.
Officially remove it.
If it's removed, your score will jump up.
Right.
But if it shows paid or not paid, your score is going to be the exact same. So I'd say don't pay it off. You know, I mean, I hate to say, I mean, if you got a debt, you should pay it. But if you're trying to improve your credit score,
and get it removed.
And a lot of these folks, you know, these are some of these collection agencies are real bottom feeders, and
right, yeah.
you know, they're not going to give you that deletion letter, no matter how good of a negotiator you are. Sometimes,
and sometimes but, the more reputable ones, if that yes. are out there, right? the yeah. two that are out there, but
right,
good thing we don't have any folks on the station today. But the is that it's you paid it. But it just kind of slips through. It doesn't.
It just doesn't factor into the formula.
Yeah, it's just not on their short list to make it happen. So maybe right. sometimes it's easy as a phone call or a letter. But you gotta be proactive. Is what
that's
you're saying.
That's right. I mean, they've got right. They've got their job to do too, and they're collecting a debt, and you owe that debt most of the times. So you should pay it.
Right. Once they get paid, they're not going to go out of their way to you know trigger all the processes that is required to remove it.
But I've seen people with they owe $15 right. and it's on their collection. It's like obviously this was an oversight. Everybody can scrape up $15.
Yeah.
But still, they've just had trouble getting that deletion letter. But cool. some people do it, and when you do it, your score can jump up, and that's a big deal.
Absolutely. I do have one more question. We got to move on, but sure. This isn't on our. We didn't talk about this before, but we do a lawyer show, Atlanta Legal Experts, and we've had a couple of folks in before talking about title insurance, and mm-hmm. they said one of the misnomers is that there was their opinion that's something that people overlook, but can be very important because you could have this house for months or years. And if it's not officially cleared, you could be up a creek or whatever, right? I mean, do you have any thoughts on title insurance?
Well, title insurance, it's one of those insurance, I guess it's kind of like the Aflac, if you don't get it, because you have a choice.
Yeah, exactly. It's optional, yes.
For the owner's title insurance. It's one of those things, if you don't get it, probably something's going to happen to you. If you do
Murphy's
get it,
Law, yeah.
it's very rare that you're ever going to use it.
They said it could be like only $1,000 or something, right?
It depends on the loan. It's all based on the purchase price.
Sure.
But it's a percentage of the purchase price, and it depends. It's a rate just like anything else. But what it does is, Pete Babcock, Campbell & Brandon, always describes it real well and says that it's a way to get the closing attorney on your side to represent you in case something happens against that house, whether a lien comes on from the previous borrower or something else that wasn't disclosed to you properly. It just covers you.
Covers you, yeah.
Because the issues,
if you want that peace of mind.
The issues that come up that would require you to use title insurance are not like $100 and $200 issues.
Right,
These
are
big issues that are
going to
cost
changer.
You a lot of money if you end up getting bit.
Losing the keys to your house or whatever. Yeah.
That's right.
Okay, so Jeff, pleasure having you here in the studio. Great information. Tell our listeners the best way to get back in touch or find out about your services.
Well, please reach out to me. You can look at our company, lendtheway.com. It's like Lead the Way, except we lend money, so we're lending the way, right. lendtheway.com. I've got a newsletter that goes out to a lot of folks, and if you want to be on that newsletter, just shoot me an email at g@lendtheway.com. Otherwise, I'll see you around town.
I get that. That lands in my inbox every month, right?
Yeah.
Hope so. It does, yeah. All right, thanks again. And maybe if we have time, we'll talk about maybe a little open forum discussion here.
Fantastic.
So thanks again. And up next, we have Emil Parody. And I don't know if we have time to talk about New Orleans, your trips down there, but Baton Rouge, or we'll see.
No,
we'll see.
We don't need to talk about that.
We don't need to talk about that. All right, we'll see how it goes, yeah. All right, so Emil's joining us, returning back to the studio as a former guest. And actually, did you co-host with me? Are you on the inaugural show?
I was on the inaugural
show.
Not a co-host.
Guest. Well, we'll see. We'll see how that goes today, yeah. Yeah. All right. So, but you're currently the owner of Referral Institute of Atlanta. You're founder of the Global Network Atlanta. Referral Institute helps clients build a business of ideal customers, right? Global Network Atlanta is an international business development initiative promoting Atlanta as a hub. I mean, it's kind of a natural city. I mean, what is it, the world's busiest airport or the largest airport?
Busiest. I just saw a thing where O'Hara passed it in one statistic as number
one.
It's nip and tuck. Usually they've been.
I think they surpass the number of baggage is being lost or whatever. Yeah, bags lost. Yeah.
Now that you mention it.
So your mission is to provide education, resources, implementation for success strategies, helping people take their business international.
Yes.
Right. And I think that's kind of a big code to crack or a big mystery, right? Because there's opportunity way beyond the shores of. America, but how do you kind of, tap into that, right? So so before we get into talking about those entities, tell us a little about yourself. How long here in Atlanta?
You were going to ask me how old I was.
Well, we can do that. We'll put that on the bio, whatever. People are tweeting that, asking that question right now.
Yeah, he's old.
Yeah, he sounds like a young kid or whatever, yeah. So former military special op?
Come on, man.
right?
I was in the Marine Corps.
Yeah, Marine Corps, yeah.
Don't throw me in the big pot.
In the big pot, yeah. So, Marine, I'm going to step back a little bit or whatever, yeah. So, originally from where?
Well, I'm not sure. My family's from Maine.
Okay.
I was born in North Carolina. My father was a Marine also. So,
oh, nice.
I just kept on moving.
How long here in Atlanta now?
Actually, this is the longest I've ever lived anywhere,
okay.
12 years.
Wow. I thought you'd been here longer than that, but so and you're been in the networking arena for many years. But talk to us about this global network in Atlanta and what's its kind of unique spin or offering.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It like so many things in life, it came out of something else. Was trying to find ways to promote Referral Institute in Atlanta, and there's such a thing as International Networking Week. And so I thought, yeah, man, it'd be good to have some sort of event participating in that with other organizations around the world. So we put something together, did that for a couple of years. And out of that, I tell people I feel like I had one foot on the boat and one foot on the dock. I was trying to serve.
That can be painful.
two purposes. But I found that there was a lot of interest in businesses in learning more about how they could go into either international markets or serve international businesses here. So we changed our focus a little bit and moved from just the networking aspect into actual business development. It dawned on me about that time that I was an international business as a business coach. I had clients in Egypt, Italy, Canada, and Ireland at the time.
How did you acquire those, or what was the
got the network out there? You got the web, the nets wide.
Oh yeah, I've heard about that. Whatever. Yeah.
And so you get recommended into this, into that, and
LinkedIn discussion groups and things, or
a little bit of that. But really, all those clients at that time were the result of direct personal introductions.
Yeah. so you mentioned this ability for folks to take their widget or their sources or their product or overseas, mm-hmm. but also the opportunity for them to do business with entities here. Is there more of an emphasis on one or the other, or is there a percentage, or now are you refocusing just on one versus the other? Or?
Well, I don't know if I can focus on anything. I seem to have a problem that way. But
coffee or whatever, yeah.
But the I think the business that we've been involved in that regard has been pretty evenly divided. Doing a lot of work in South America right now, Ecuador particularly, but a few other countries as well. But, it's like anything. Once you get going and establish yourself as a credible resource, things show up.
Right.
There's a lot of folks out there looking for help. And if they can find someone, you go back to the VCP.
Right.
First, you got to be visible, let them find you. And then the second thing is they got to trust you. And if you can create relationships with people, either you're going to get a direct trust or you're going to get a trust as the result of their relationship with someone else that you've established a relationship with.
Yes. Yeah, speaking of trust and developing that, do you find it easier, or what's the differences, I should say, and challenges of connecting with someone overseas and building that relationship as opposed to face-to-face? I mean, there's really two sides of that coin, because in some cases it might be, easier, right? But in some cases...
Yeah, in some ways it is easier. If you can be there for them, that goes a long ways. The other part of it, though, is there's, no matter what people say, there are some cultural differences have to be considered. Mm-hmm. And if you're not able to adjust to those pretty rapidly, then you're going to have some problems. Either you're just going to get frustrated or you're going to frustrate them.
Right.
So, that creating those relationships and the credibility is really important.
Yeah. Speaking of that, for cultures, I mean, do you do coaching or is there training or recommendations, sources that you recommend? Because it's, say I want to start doing business in China. That sounds great. There's all kinds of people over there. There's great business. But, I could shoot myself in the foot or do myself a disservice, right? I mean.
Yeah, I'd probably be one of the last people that you'd want to have train anyone in anything to do with sensitivity to to those kinds of things. Yeah. But I do have a few folks that I work with are great at it and in fact, specialize in just that thing.
Because I'm just trying to wrap my head. I don't know if we have time or if you can run through kind of, you know, picture how if somebody has this startup or this, a very established business and they just, like you said, want to expand an international market. I mean, what's the walk us through, you know, what's the process? And
well, it could be as simple as establishing yourself on the internet. People are going to find you from all over the world. And that's really one of the things that I think happens to kind of that accidental thing.
Right.
It's interesting, though, because I've just been doing a little bit of research and read a few things about how to make your website more international friendly.
Or Google friendly.
Well, international.
God friendly or Google. It's
But international friendly. There are some things, you know, as just as simple as if you're trying to conduct e-commerce, how do you go about doing that? How do they pay you? You know, there's how do you state prices? So, in whose money?
Right.
So there's a lot of things that you have to start considering, and it's good to have someone that's maybe been down that trail before just to sit and talk with you a little bit. Do it yourself is great. I'm a great do it yourselfer, but on the other hand, there's some times where you need to have an expert in there, and the thing that we've done with Global Network ATL is bring those experts together to make them readily accessible to folks and get a little guidance. Who do you need?
Yeah, because you could have very successful, uber successful business in Buckhead, but that doesn't translate to Bangladesh, right? And it could be just as simple as you see some of these websites and it's like what worked here in, you know, Kennesaw or Alpharetta, you've got to retool your website with just some simple integration with just all the international languages, right? So they can then read your website, your content in their native language.
Yeah, and you know, you just made me think of a great quote by Mike Gomez, which goes back to Baton Rouge. He said, "If you want to go international, how about going Louisiana first, and then go international, or go Texas first?
Right.
You learn how to operate with people in another time zone, away from where you are. Depending on the type of business you have, that could be very important for you. Just learning how to accommodate those differences, the logistics of having, people not within your reach, and time zone differences can make a big difference.
Yeah,
as
time
well.
Zone is huge. I mean, so you have to ramp up your staff or outsource some type of call center or services that can be there when your potential prospects need your services.
But I would like to make one little asterisk down there. Doing business internationally can be incredibly easy as well. And it can be incredibly easy because there's so many great resources, starting with the state, starting with your county, the chambers of commerce, the federal government. If you can make yourself aware of those resources and learn how to utilize them, you can move your way very rapidly into international markets.
Well, and speaking of resources here in Atlanta, I mean, I think at least – I'm sure there's more, but I've been to a few events where there's like a collection of all the international global chambers of commerce. Like there's 38 at least that come to mind that operate right here in our city, right? So it could be as easy, like you said, because it sounds a little overwhelming when you start thinking about, you know, the ripple effect of languages and currency and translation and time zones. But you could reach out to the Swedish Chamber of Commerce or wherever country you're seeking. And I'm sure they would welcome to have a conversation with you, right? I mean, that's their role here, your capacity.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned them because that's where I do have made most of my connections is through those binational chambers.
Yeah.
Depending on who's counting, there's 38 or 40 or some number of them out there. There's events going on all the time. A great resource is, Global Connect?
Global Connect, I think,
and Global Atlanta, the online newsletter. They put out some great information, a great schedule of international events during the week, and you know they're easy enough to chip in. And those folks are, as you said, there for the purpose of helping people do business with their country.
Yeah, and it's as easy as talking about networking. They host their monthly or weekly their networking events. So if you're seeking to do business in Madagascar or Australia, right, or the UK, you can go to their event.
Yeah.
And now you're in a fishbowl with all these people that have, you don't even have to, at that juncture, you don't have to travel to, Istanbul or whatever, right? You can just go to a Buckhead bar and meet these folks, right?
Yeah. Talking about travel, one of the things that we've done, and not to the extent that we thought we were, but we still do somewhat, and that's the use of video conferencing and whatnot to make introductions with people and to do business with people in other places without having to actually go there.
Because you've done that at a couple of your global events, whatever, right?
Right.
Yep. What a couple of countries you were tapped into?
At the time, I think the first ones we did were in Ireland and the UK and in Ecuador.
Ecuador, yeah. That's what I was thinking as well. So let's talk about your quarterly breakfast and then kind of the big picture, mission and how people find out about this. But, and we want to talk about, how it helps here, right here for Atlantans. But the quarterly breakfast, what's that about?
Yeah, we're going from trying to do a big OORA annual event to doing quarterly breakfasts that are a little more focused. One's going to be more real estate investment focused, both commercial and residential. That I hadn't set out to do that, but that was brought to me. somebody said, hey, why don't we do one like this? We'd like to participate in that. So that one's there, and then the other one's directed towards import-export, the traditional doing business, providing support to international business. So those will be smaller activities, and I hope more focused. We're hopefully going to do the old one of my tenets of networking that you should keep in mind. You always go in pairs, and we're going to use this at our breakfast. You need two people, one to hold them, the other one to hit them. So that's how you get the business. So our job is to hold them, and the job of the people that want to do business is to come in and hit them.
It's a breakfast breakdown or whatever, smackdown or whatever.
Sure. That's it.
So where do these typically happen, or when's the next one coming up, or how would people find out about?
Yeah, we'll be doing the next one in January. And then we'll be doing two a quarter, one of each quarter.
Have you selected the venue or the location, date, and time yet for January? Or stay tuned.
I thought we were coming over to your place.
Sure, we'll have it right here, whatever. Yeah, we got coffee and there's some leftover bagels. I think we do bagels every Friday, so if you can plan it on Friday, we're good.
Now we'll be getting that out, the word out through our network, and it'll be on our website and so forth.
And what is the website to find out about the Global Network Atlanta?
Well, we have globalnetworkatl.com, and then we have referralinstituteatlanta.com. I tried to make that longer, Referral Institute Atlanta, and I was trying to think what else I could get in there.
Atlanta, Georgia, or
you're
throwing some hieroglyphics there. Yeah. But on the so to finish, so that's about, we kind of spent a lot of time talking about the Global Network Atlanta. So let's kind of finish up on this referral, because there are really two different entities. I mean, is there overlap there? Not really, or yes?
Yeah, there is. Okay. There is overlap in that I do provide marketing coaching and consulting to, there it is.
Yeah, I got your email in my inbox this morning, Referral Success 101.
So we do
good
some
thing I didn't delete it earlier.
That's right. Yeah, that's an intro session to kind of open the door to let people know that there's a little bit of science to this.
And there is kind of overlap here, because not only is it happening November 19th from 4 to 6:15. Why 6:15, not 6:30 or 6? crank them out.
Question and answers.
Yeah. But then, and speaking of international, it's happening at the Georgia Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. So
exactly.
There you go.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Good stuff. And that's what, $800 to attend, or what's the...
I think that was $20.
Okay, that's it sounds a lot better already,
But you can negotiate your way in.
Okay, and you're on Twitter. I see you got your Twitter handle, Global Network ATL.
Mm-hmm.
So what else do we need to know?
I'm pretty modern, aren't I?
Yeah, you're all over it.
That Twitter thing.
Yeah. Welcome to the Twitter sphere. So what else do we need to know, Emil, before we wrap up here?
Well, I always like people to know that it's... always happy to talk to people, and it's okay to buy me a beer.
Exactly. Yeah. Wherever there's a beer, Emil's nearby or whatever. Yeah. So thanks for being here, and stay tuned. Maybe a little additional conversation here. But finally, we have up our anchor man here this morning. Been patiently waiting. Terrence, welcome back to the show. How are you so far?
I'm doing awesome. Thanks for having me.
All right. So Now, talk to us about you kind of did a little tease. It's Read Attack 2.0, right? Yeah. And so this is what, a new accounting software, and it's being officially launched in the new year, January, right?
Correct.
And the focus is designed to equip nonprofit organizations with the tools necessary to run their mission, because a lot of times they get so passionate about what they're doing, but they need, you know, these tools, right, to kind of make it more efficient so they can put more emphasis on their project. Is that yes or yes?
Absolutely. Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct.
Okay, so how did this kind of come about? Before we jump into the Rita 2.0, tell us a bit about, for our listeners who may not be familiar with yourself, what's a little your background? How long in Atlanta? What's your story?
Well, actually, believe it or not, I've had over 15 years of working and developing and growing nonprofits.
Okay.
And over that period of time, I've seen a lot of nonprofits come and go.
Right.
And over the years, as we were getting nonprofits really in an area where they can not only become sustainable, but we saw a lot of nonprofits as they were growing, just not following the business side of being a business.
Right.
And for so often, nonprofits would be so caught up in their technical skills and the activities that they really never became a business. And what was frustrating for us, as you go through our training, you know, 5, 6, 7 months later, we come back and say, how's everything going? And they say, you know what, we're still doing the things we were doing, but we just haven't gotten around to making sure that we've done the administrative services.
Yeah.
And what I found amazing in that process is that there were always softwares out there available to do that. It was just so intimidating for nonprofits to have to use something like QuickBooks. You know, you really need to really be an accountant to understand how to really use that on a very strong level. And so they just didn't do it. So most of the time they were keeping this information either in Word or Excel. And most of the time having to convert that to something to an accountant was just so very nuisome when it was time to do that at the end of the year. So as we began to look at that, we started looking at ways of how to take that and simplify that process.
Yeah, a lot of times just kind of antiquated and then potentially creating more work or more problems or whatever, right? And takes away from their attention of their mission.
Correct.
Right. So, so this launches in January.
It does. It does.
And who's your ideal, you know, candidate? Is there a size of a organization or in a certain sector of nonprofits? Or
well, believe it or not, this software is really designed for every type of nonprofit. Even though we break them down into categories, where there are small nonprofits with less than 25 employees, 250,000 in terms of gross, to mid-sized nonprofits that could go up as high as 100 employees, with somewhere around about $1 million, $1.5 million, and then some of the larger ones that are certainly 30, 40 million, 300-plus employees. The difference in that process is how they simply use this nonprofit software. And one of the things that's important in this process to understand is that our model is somewhere different than most nonprofit softwares. What we do is that we create products and services that work in conjunction with the current offering of the nonprofit. So it doesn't require you to have to change your mission, who you are, and even what your target market is. What it does, it says this allows you to be able to generate other types of income to make you sustainable. And I think at the end of the day, that allows you to stretch your mission into people who may not have otherwise been able to use your services.
Now, how does that work? Generating additional income or?
Yeah.
It's not just savings from an efficiency standpoint?
That's exactly right.
So what's an example? If I started a nonprofit in January, how would using this technology, I mean, how would I see additional income?
Well, here's a great way to look at this as an example. Let's say, for instance, this was a nonprofit, this radio show.
Some days it is.
All right. One of the things that will happen is that obviously your current offering is this particular show.
Right.
And you come on and people can obviously advertise. That's probably a simple way to look at it. But what we also would do inside of this software would say, what else could you be doing in conjunction with what you're already doing? When obviously you can do workshops, seminars, those kinds of things would be something simpler. You also could go on and do business coaching yourself would be another way to generate income as that comes in.
So you're kind of coaching them on things that they may not be apparent to them.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So those would be a couple examples of what would happen that wouldn't take you away from being the radio host that you are great at that. It also says, here are some of the things that you may be leaving on the table. What this software does, it also takes a look at that and it kind of forecasts to you the kind of capital that's left on the table that you could be using inside the business to continue to grow the business.
Yeah.
So in days where that may not be advertisement dollar at the highest level, you could continue to have assets coming in a different way.
Well, thinking of some nonprofits, actually, we just had our morning show this morning. We had a nonprofit, and this afternoon show, we're going to have three or four different nonprofits. We're having the Atlanta Food Bank in here. We have a athlete. I'm not for, if we're allowed to release his name, but he's a Spoonful of Hope.
Yeah.
And there's we have, I think there's about four different nonprofits. So what you're saying is kind of like expand on what they're doing without getting too away from their core, right?
That's exactly right. This software really, in a nutshell, allows us to be able to use a business strategy in order to sustain a nonprofit. And since there are no shareholders inside of a nonprofit, and all of the income that comes out of the new income generating profit streams get reinvested back into the nonprofit's work.
Now, I don't want to put you on the spot because you can pass or play on this one here or whatever, but I'm just curious, like, is there been a, you know, beta nonprofits you've been working with ramping up in 2014 that you've been kind of beta testing.
And that's really where we are right now in the beta testing format with this process. And we've worked with some smaller nonprofits in which we are obviously growing into larger nonprofits. And we work with some larger nonprofits on creating other types of activities that allow them to be a little bit more sustainable and not have to rely so much on grants and contributions. And that's going to be, I believe, in my opinion, a real problem as things start to grow over the next couple of years, because they're asking nonprofits now to bring capital to the table and show sustainabilities and outcome even before they submit any type of new capital towards their work.
You know, we talk obviously a lot about kind of B2B or business for profit, but I'm kind of curious because, you know, I think the general consensus or track record is what most businesses fail within the first 3 years. If they can make it past the 3 year mark, they got a better odds. What's the track record like for nonprofits? You've been at it for how many years now?
Yeah, 15 years now.
Yeah.
And so, believe it or not, that time frame is just about the same.
Really?
Unless you get some infusion of capital. Because what happened, if you really think about it, the first year is more about capital you're invested in yourself towards whatever your passion is. And then hopefully somebody gives you some form of a fusion of small capital that may get you the year two and three. But once that goes out, the person typically goes back to what they used to do, and sometimes that's a job.
I was just thinking, though, if they start out day one not to make a profit, then how could they go out of business, right? Because
and you know what the misconception of that process is?
Yeah.
Most nonprofits believe that the federal government is saying to them that you cannot make a profit. And that's exactly what it says. It doesn't say you can't generate income.
Right.
And believe it or not, when nonprofits first set out, they either have one or two different types of business model. One business model is a service-driven business model, which says you beg for the money, you give away the service. And that's sort of a goodwill strategy. The second business model says it's an income generating portion, where it says at the end of the day that you create activities that allow you to generate income that comes into the nonprofit, allow you to be able to spread your message and increase your mobility of being around for, you know, future ventures. And this way you're able to not only do what you need to get done in terms of having indirect cost you can address, but it also allows you to be able to take those kind of dollars and put them to where they're really needed and not just have to spend it the way the grant or the contributor suggests that you do it.
So walk me through a little bit of the process of, like, because we have not only our current listeners listen to us live, but this is archived in perpetuity, right? So people will be listening to this months and years down the road, right? Yeah. And so having said that, if someone's listening and they're involved in a nonprofit, what's the processes for, you know, them to not only, we'll talk about, you know, we'll go ahead and mention the website. So right now while we're thinking of it. We'll,
right now is RitaSoftware.com, or you can go to RitaTech.org.
Or, yeah. And then, but what's the processes like? Do you meet with them? Do they get a trial experience? Is there like a, you know, consultation? Is there some people that would be a good fit, others wouldn't be? I mean, so if, you know, if someone's, you know, listening with nonprofit ears, what's your message of like, you know, the process to incorporate and either cost, you know, what potential cost savings? I don't know how many. That's what, about seven questions right there? Yeah.
Well, first of all, we do obviously sit down and speak with the nonprofit, and we begin the process of taking you through what we call a social enterprise audit. And that begins to let the nonprofit look at two things. Number one, you know, how susceptible is your organization right now to become an enterprise? Because believe it or not, some of them are just so passionate about what they are doing that they cannot conceive the idea of charging somebody for the service. when at the end of the day, somebody still has to sit across the desk. Somebody still has to keep the lights on.
Absolutely.
Somebody still got to make payroll.
Right.
That's number one. Number two, it then looks at a sustainability process that says, okay, now that we've done that, how much capital do you have coming in? And if you were no longer receiving this capital, how would you sustain yourself?
Okay.
And then number three, the software comes in is when we take all that data and begin to say to you, here's how you now take that and you chronicle it into your system and you follow it through this software system to allow you to continue to maintain that stability throughout the years.
So that's kind of the initial steps, obviously. So,
correct.
So do they? There's an opportunity they can kind of test drive it or whatever. Or once you meet with them, it's either a fit or not a fit, or it makes sense for them.
Correct.
I mean,
correct. Now, what happens in that process is that then you purchase the software and you take the information that we've taken from you,
right,
put it in there, and you're able to now monitor where you are, and then certainly come up with other products and services that you can stick into the system and forecast how much capital can be drawn from that.
And is it too early to talk about pricing, or
well,
like
right
Jeff
now,
was saying, it just depends, whatever,
well,
right?
and years ago, we used to take a look at this, and we would kind of say to you, we would scale it based on the size of
the that's
profit.
What I was kind of thinking.
And that's
maybe
really what we do. For smaller nonprofits, this runs about $3.99. For mid-sized nonprofits, somewhere around $6.99. And for larger nonprofits with about 300 employees, could run you around $1,500.
Sure, and that's
year.
The initial investment. Is there ongoing subscription or follow-up consultation and services? Or
well,
is it
actually,
kind of
this is an annual subscription.
Okay.
So it's a cloud-based software that requires you to have to be able to renew that every year.
Yeah, that's the secret sauce right there, whatever.
No,
yeah.
No question.
Nice. So I don't know. Tell us again, our listeners, to find out about the software program, the website. Or
you can simply go to readertech.org,
uh-huh,
or you can go to readertechsoftware.com.
Okay.
And if you want to reach out to us personally, it's 404-267-1851. Or if you're outside of Atlanta, we have a toll-free number of 1-888-494-9532.
Yeah, speaking about, I was going to ask that a minute ago, talk about the international conversation we had here, is that so can folks use this throughout Georgia, obviously, and beyond throughout the U.S., or is it limited in
Well, right now we're obviously throughout the U.S. We're okay. Making some transition now to do some things international and allow the software to be in multiple different languages.
I got a guy I could introduce you to that might be able to help you with that. And so you could open up markets in New Zealand or whatever.
Correct.
Ecuador.
Correct.
It's a big language problem in New Zealand.
Any of you guys want to need help in Australia, I'm willing to go there. I don't know how much help I could be, but I can get you a beer in Australia maybe. Yeah. Okay, so we're just about out of time. Terrence, pleasure having you here this morning and helping you get the good word out. And maybe off the air, we can introduce you to some of these folks that are nonprofits. And I think it sounds like a win-win, and certainly for something for them viable to take a look at. Any closing comments, gentlemen, here? Observations, takeaways, questions? Great quotes for the day, a joke? Hello, is this on? That was optional. I didn't want to put you on the spot here, whatever. Yeah.
Quotes.
You didn't tell us we had to have jokes.
Exactly.
Fish and visitors smell after 3 days. I don't know.
That's really one of the things I would
like a quote or a joke, but yeah, thanks for, yeah.
One of the things I would certainly like to leave this audience is the fact that understand that just because you're a nonprofit doesn't mean you don't have to have business. That's what it is a nonprofit business.
Well, I was going to say, I've worked with a lot of nonprofits and seen them, and it's rare that somebody from the business community actually starts a nonprofit. Us business folks are trained to think about profits.
Yeah.
And so it's usually somebody who sees a need and they're very passionate about what they do, that maybe they have limited business experience. And when people are giving you a lot of money, that's a lot of responsibility.
Correct.
And I think it's really great what you're doing, and
thank you.
You're successful.
Yeah, if we're not going into overtime, I'm actually the director of a nonprofit and have been for about 10 years in what you said.
Thank you.
You concur?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Amen.
Absolutely.
All right. So great stuff here this morning. I want to thank all of our guests for being here. And another edition in the can or on the internet or somewhere.
In the ether.
In the ether. Thank you. Yeah. So that wraps up another edition of Buckhead Business Radio. Your host, Rich Casanova. We'll see you next time. And stay tuned.